to episode 8 of the StoryGrid Editor Roundtable podcast. This is a show dedicated to helping you become a better editor, following the StoryGrid method developed by Sean Coyne, an editor with over 25 years' experience. My name is Anne Hawley, and I'll be moderating the roundtable today. Joining me shortly are four of my fellow certified StoryGrid editors, Leslie Watts, Kim Kessler, Valerie Francis, and Jari Bolander. Each week, we watch a movie from one of the 12 content genres and complete a Global Foolscap worksheet, then we discuss it using the 6 core questions. This week, we're analyzing the 1992 movie The Muppet Christmas Carol, directed by Brian Henson with screenplay by Jerry Jewell. It is one of approximately 10 bazillion adaptations of Charles Dickens' classic A Christmas Carol, and it may not even be the only one featuring songs and puppets. Here's a synopsis of the original story, which this screenplay follows very closely. I adapted this from SparkNotes. This version is narrated by the great Gonzo, who says he's Charles Dickens, and assisted by Rizzo the Rat. There are songs every few minutes that don't appear to advance the plot, but that forward the emotional content of the story. A mean-spirited, miserly old man named Ebenezer Scrooge, played by Michael Caine, sits in his counting house on a frigid Christmas Eve. He's too cheap to heat his outer office and too miserly to give to charity, and he says bah humbug in response to his nephew's Merry Christmas. That evening, in his dark, cold apartment, Scrooge receives a chilling visitation from the ghost of his dead partner, Jacob Marley. In this version, it's from the Marley brothers, played by the two Muppet guys who normally sit in the balcony and criticize everyone. Marley tells how his greedy and self-serving life has condemned his spirit to wander the earth in chains. This happens in a song. He hopes to save Scrooge from the same fate. 3 spirits will visit him, Marley says, and Scrooge collapses into a deep sleep. He wakes to the childlike ghost of Christmas past, who escorts Scrooge on a journey into his past. There he witnesses several instances when his lust for money ruined his chances to be loved and to love. Scrooge, deeply moved, sheds tears of regret before the phantom returns him to his bed. Next, the ghost of Christmas present takes Scrooge through London to unveil Christmas as it will happen that year. Scrooge watches the large, bustling family of his clerk, Bob Cratchit, played by Kermit the Frog, prepare a scanty feast in their poor home. Bob Cratchit's crippled son, Tiny Tim, warms Scrooge's heart with his courage, kindness, and humility. The specter then zips Scrooge to his nephew's house to witness the Christmas party Scrooge earlier said bah humbug to. The jovial gathering is so delightful that Scrooge begs the spirit to let him stay. As the day passes, the spirit grows older. Toward the end of the day, he shows Scrooge 2 starved children, Ignorance and Want, living under his coat, then vanishes. A dark hooded figure comes toward him. This is the ghost of Christmas yet to come, who shows Scrooge businessmen discussing a recently dead man's riches, vagabonds selling the dead man's personal effects, and a poor couple expressing relief at the death of their unforgiving creditor. Scrooge is shown a headstone in a graveyard and is shocked to read his own name. He begs the spirit to alter his fate, promising to renounce his insensitive, avaricious ways and to honor Christmas with all his heart. He awakens safe in his bed on Christmas Day. Overjoyed by the chance for redemption, Scrooge rushes out into the street to share his newfound Christmas spirit. He sends a turkey to the Cratchits and shows up at the party that he said bah humbug to. He honors Christmas with all his heart. He treats Tiny Tim as if he were his own child, provides lavish gifts for the poor, and treats his fellow human beings with kindness, generosity, and warmth. You can just hear the music playing. So, speaking of the music, we'd like to start with talking a little bit about the musical form. This is a style genre added onto the morality redemption story here. Some of us liked the songs and some didn't. I think a lot depends on your age when you first saw it or the age of your children when you first saw it. And we thought it would be worthwhile to think about what purpose the songs serve in a story like this. In some musicals, the songs proceed from the setting, like in Cabaret or Moulin Rouge, where the characters are actually performers and it's logical that they should perform. Some have characters bursting into song out of the blue. Some use songs to develop the plot, like Hamilton, where you can listen to the soundtrack and get the whole story without hearing any of the talking. And some songs simply emphasize a mood or feeling. So I wanted to kind of open it up and get some views on the songs in this movie. Because to be perfectly honest, I ignored them all.
Well, and just bah humbugs, all I can say to that. Seriously. I recommended this movie this week because it's one of my all-time favorites. And of course, my introduction to this was watching it with my kids. And this is one of the ones that we watch every single year. I also watch the Alistair Sim version every year because this is one of my favorite stories. But the songs, for me, what not only this version does, but what the songs do is they make a classic like A Christmas Carol accessible to very young audiences and expose them to classical literature. And when you're dealing with very young audiences, you've got to do that a certain way. Like the songs in this version are on the nose. They totally are on the nose. Like the very first song is introducing Scrooge, and they tell you outright what kind of guy he is, and we hear it from a bunch of different points of view. So there's no wondering. He's a black hat, right? He's not a white hat. He's a black hat, for sure.
Right.
So I really like them. And then there's one with Kermit, who's Bob Cratchit, when he leaves on Christmas Eve and goes home, and it's the Penguins' Christmas party. Well, that's just fun. I don't think there's any real reason in terms of story for that one, other than it's fun and it shows a transition and it takes the story away from the seriousness and the grimness in Scrooge's office to something that's a little lighter and easier, more palatable for young audiences. I still love it.
I felt like I was following along with the text of the original A Christmas Carol, and it seemed to me that the songs served as sort of narrative exposition mortar between the bricks of the story, because the story is really fairly simple. Kind of there are three big events in it, and in between, in Dickens's version, there's a great deal of very Dickensian exposition, and the songs filled a lot of that in for the audience just by mood and, you know, setting the mood.
Yeah, exactly.
Clarifying the characters and so forth.
Exactly. It explains it to them. And I mean, there's other things that are on the nose too. Like we're introduced to Gonzo as Charles Dickens, and then they very quickly explain who Charles Dickens is. And later on in the film, they explain what an omniscient narrator is. And, you know,
that was
really good, right?
Those are some of my favorite parts.
And Rizzo at one point says, well, this is kind of spooky and scary. Isn't this a bit too much for kids? And Gonzo said, it's okay, it's culture.
You know? There was a certain amount of fourth wall breaking.
So I love the Muppets. When I grew up as a kid, I watched it every time it was on. The singing part's the thing that just doesn't get me. Even as a kid, I didn't like the singing. So I see your point, and it is used very well. In fact, it's funny, and it's very inviting. And I'm sure kids are going to love it because kids love dancing and singing and anything that they can repeat like a billion times. Like my niece sings the Frozen song, Let It Go, a billion times. And you're like, oh, my God, this is like crack to them. They love it.
Well, I think it's an interesting question about story structure and this idea that this is for children, or that because it's a musical and for children, there's an extra piece that's needed in a story. As writers and editors, we probably won't be adding songs, but it's an interesting question. What does the music serve in a musical? And we should probably watch some more musicals and try and figure that out.
Oh I second that one. Absolutely.
No. Okay, well, I know I have to expand my horizons, but...
You do!
Besides Les Miserables, I fell asleep at. And I'm not going to mention the one that I really enjoyed on Broadway because I'll lose my man card.
Legally Blonde.
Yeah, okay. It was Legally Blonde. It was awesome. Okay, it was awesome.
Let's go on to the global genre now before we get too lost down the musical hole here. Kim, let's hear about the global genre.
So the global genre is morality redemption. It's the internal genre of the story, and it definitely takes center stage. So the values at stake in a morality redemption story or any morality story is going to be selfishness to altruism. And the spectrum can go all the way from the negation of the negation, which would be selfishness masked as altruism, and then all the way to sacrificing self for all humanity. In this case, for the Christmas Carol, I'm putting it from selfishness to putting the tribe's needs above oneself. You know, you have this whole range, but your story isn't necessarily going to cross the entire range. So I think it went from just him being really selfish to then he puts the needs of his community above his own. And then for the external genre in this case, I marked it as a society story where it emphasizes the power divide between rich and poor. And in this case, the revolution happens when Scrooge himself chooses to change and gives power and wealth to the others in his town.
Great call on the society genre.
For me, the external genre is a horror supernatural because of the ghosts. Oh. Obviously, there is a society element. I'm not going to argue that point at all because it's right on the money. But to me, that's more of the backdrop for the story.
Okay.
The story is about, for me, Scrooge's, obviously, it's about Scrooge's redemption, right? Him going from a black heart to a good guy. And the vehicle for that is through the ghosts. So for me, this is a ghost story.
I don't know, because see, horror to me, and even the supernatural is there, is something that wants to kill you. Mm-hmm. And so there is some...
In this case, it wants to redeem him.
Yeah, like and it's him. Not like a direct threat to Scrooge in terms of, I'm chasing you to cut
right.
your head off.
It's not like the attack of the monster kind
no,
of thing.
No, but yeah. if a horror story was the global genre, it would be very different. But the global genre here is a morality redemption, right? Scrooge is very much at risk. It's his soul that's at risk,
right.
not his
right.
physical self, but his soul.
Right. His soul.
Which is why Jacob and Robert Marley in this film, in this version, why they come to warn him in the first place, because he
right.
is at risk of being damned just like they are. This is another reason for the songs, right? Because this is pretty dark.
Right.
you know? So you know. You need to lighten it up somehow. And I personally love the Jacob and Robert Marley joke. I think it's brilliant. That's put in there for the parents, not for the kids, because my kids didn't get that one for years. And really, in terms of it being a society story, no one really is combating Ebenezer Scrooge. They're not trying to rise up against him. I mean, you've got
right.
the first Muppet who comes in, Applegate, I think his name is, who doesn't have money for his mortgage, and he has come to try and reason with Scrooge, but Scrooge just throws him out, and then that's it. In the ending payoff, we have someone who comes close to challenging Scrooge, and that's Mrs. Cratchit, who's played by Miss Piggy. So if anyone is ever going to be able to challenge Scrooge, it's Miss Piggy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a real challenge. It's more of a
right.
gag.
Right.
Right. And it's when Scrooge comes to, he's pretending to still be cranky, and he actually comes to pay off the mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, you know, she's about to raise him right off the pavement. But that's more of a Muppet gag and not really a serious threat to Scrooge's authority.
I think it's safe to say with Dickens that it's always something about society. I mean, there's
right.
always a society
yeah.
story
yeah.
lurking in all everything he wrote. All right. Well, we'd like to turn to Leslie now for the beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff. Take it away, Leslie.
Okay. Beginning hook is Christmas Eve arrives and Ebenezer Scrooge is interrupted by his nephew, people collecting charitable donations, and a caroler. But when the end of the workday comes and Bob Cratchit and the rest of the staff request time off for the holiday, he must decide if he will give them the day off or not. He agrees, but he tells them they must come to work early on December 26. Scrooge goes home to spend Christmas alone, or so he thinks. In the middle build, Scrooge arrives home and he sees the face of one of the Marley brothers, his former business partners, on the door knocker, and the ghost of Christmas past shows him a painful memory of Belle, his fiancée, ending their relationship. But when visiting the Cratchit home and his words about decreasing the surplus population are repeated to him in reference to Tiny Tim, Scrooge must decide whether to hang on to his selfish ways or change and consider the welfare of others. He tells the ghost of Christmas present that he has changed and asks if he can avoid the next visitor. But the ghost tells him that he does, in fact, have one more visitor. He can't get out of it.
Ooh.
Ending payoff. The ghost of Christmas yet to come shows Scrooge people talking badly about a man he presumes is like him and takes him to Bob Cratchit's home, where he learns that Tiny Tim has died. But when the specter shows him his own grave, Scrooge must decide whether to ask for the opportunity to change or not. He asks and wakes up on Christmas morning, then goes about redeeming himself for his selfish behavior. Scrooge becomes a good man, and Tiny Tim lives.
Awesome. And this story follows story structure so perfectly that you're just, I mean, it's such a great example of beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff. It's so clear. It's wonderful.
I guess the thing that I would add is that it feels to me when I am just hitting the five commandments of storytelling for each of the three acts that it's missing stuff. And that could be just the way that I'm writing it. But I don't feel like I know the story, obviously, so I understand what's happening in between. But maybe there's a way that I could write it that it would give more of a sense of the entire story that
which ones did you feel like were missing,
like complications are missing, or
yeah, the complications in the middle build, the progressive complication feels like when he meets his fiance or when he sees the painful memory of breaking up with his fiance, but the turning point seems to be, at least in this version, when he's at the Cratchit home and a different ghost repeats his words to him. And that seems to be what creates the dilemma
for him. In this one, it felt progressive to me.
Remember, the whole point of this is a macro view. And this is a challenge. I was talking to a writer the other day who was having a very similar challenge with her own story because she knows it so well. So it was really hard for her to pull back to the 30,000 foot view and give just a sentence or two about the beginning hook, another sentence or two about the middle build, and another one about the ending payoff. So you definitely are going to miss things, absolutely. And that's fine. That's the point. Because this is just a real high-level look at the story. So I think you're fine.
Yeah,
I agree. You hit it all. We can certainly go back and add more notes if we want to. Let's go on to the obligatory scenes. What are the obligatory scenes of a morality redemption story, Jari?
So the first one is that there has to be a shock that upsets the hibernating authentic self. And this is done really well in all three of the Christmas past, present, and yet to come. But specifically when he's a boy, and you can kind of tell why he's the way he is. And then he meets what would be his future wife, but he keeps on delaying them getting married. And then this one scene, she's like, look, buddy, you used to love me, but you don't love me anymore. And that was, I think, just completely cratered him as it would. So he really wanted to find love and be in love, and his past as a boy and his future just completely, now he's the way he is, and that's kind of sad. So you sort of understand that. You know, the Christmas present, you see some of that when people are making fun of him, and especially his nephew and his some of his employees. And then in the future, people are laughing at his death, and so he's just really, man, how could I have gotten this far? How can I get so into myself that people just don't like me? Which no one really likes him until the end.
The shocks that he suffers as one of the obligatory scenes are also big progressive complications in the story, which is interesting.
Yes. Those to me are the progressive complications of the global story. The reason why he's the way he is. And you can only be like, well, of course he's going to be this way if you were a boy and, you know, you're not being nurtured, and then you have a love of your life and you don't know how to deal with that, and all you care about is money, and it's just...
So in that way, it's kind of like they're progressive revelations to the audience about why he is the way he is.
You know, he's reflecting, and that's a real powerful thing. A lot of times people don't reflect on why they are the way they are. I mean, this is why it stands the test of time. How many people do you know to put off their future because, oh, I'll just suck it up and I'll do another year of this or blah, 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 whatever, 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 right? They just never realize that time is short. Get out of your private pity party and make shit happen. I mean, it takes trauma, grief, realization that time on your planet is short. It takes so many things to like disrupt the status quo on that. There's no better time than the present, and he just can't get his shit together. And then finally he realizes this, right, as we talked about. And then the second one is the protagonist expresses inner darkness with an overt refusal of his hero's journey or his call to change. And this is classically done in the when his partners come, and love the those two heckler guys. I even like the song. Okay, so must admit that was a good song.
Okay.
Protagonist faces an all is lost moment and either discovers their inner moral code or chooses an immoral path. The all is lost moment in this one is when Scrooge sees his own death and no one really cares. He's just like, oh my God, my life is meaningless. Saving and scrimping and being a miser, this doesn't matter. Classic story through all of time. How many people do you know that get to the end of their life and they're like, woulda, coulda, shoulda? They were pursuing other things. So
yeah.
The fourth one, protagonist actively sacrifices self in service of an individual, a group, or humanity on the positive side, or chooses to remain selfish, which is on the negative side. And this is happens at the end, where Scrooge visits the Cratchits. He chooses to pay the mortgage, his second father to Tiny Tim. He wakes up. He's like, you know what? More to life than just money. And I need to get my act together. Protagonist faces literal or metaphorical death. Either loses the battle, but gains self-respect, meaning, and peace, or wins the battle, but loses those things. In this case, I mean, he has a metaphorical death, right? It's the
Ghost of Christmas, gravestone and all,
Christmas to be, right? Like, so, you know, he really kind of figures it out at that point where you're gone, no one cares. And I think as humans, probably I would say our biggest, you know, the thing that we never want anyone to do is forget who we are. And Michael Caine, who plays Scrooge, just does an awesome job. You know, you feel the shift.
Mm.
His old ways die. He loses, you know, what he was, and now he's trying to gain his new self. And then the last one is the big event or the thing that, like, brings it all together. And then, of course, in this case, at least to me, it's Scrooge after waking up. Hey, I'm now going to go spread Christmas joy and be a good guy.
That's fantastic. Now we need to look at the conventions of the morality redemption story, which Valerie is going to take on in her usual excellent fashion.
Thanks, Anne. Okay, so there are five. First off, you need to have a self-obsessed protagonist at the outset of the story. And of course, Scrooge is definitely that. His heart is black and he's sort of the epitome of a bad guy. And yes, in this version, we have obviously the song that tells us that he's a bad guy, but we also have that really excellent scene in his office where we get several examples of how self-obsessed he is. He doesn't care that Mr. Applegate's daughter is sick, and that's why he's behind on his rent. He wants his money. For him, December is not the month that Christmas falls in. December is harvest time for the moneylenders. He doesn't care that his bookkeepers are cold and want an extra shovel full of coal. And there's a great gag there. The little rats say, our assets are frozen. I love that one. Every time, I know it's coming and it makes me laugh every time. My dad was an accountant, so that cracks him up too. When Fred comes in to wish him Merry Christmas, he not only says humbug to the Merry Christmas, but he also criticizes him for having gotten married. And he obviously refuses to donate any money to the Order of Victoria Charity Foundation. And this is where one of the great lines from the book comes in. And he says that if the poor would rather die than go to prisons or poorhouses, then they'd better do it and decrease the surplus population. I mean, how grumpy, how crooked can a person be? He even refuses to help a bunny and leaves the bunny in the snow.
A poor
this is
little
heartbreaking.
I loved especially that when he says Christmas is harvest time for moneylenders, we get a glint of gold on his teeth.
That's right. The second one is there has to be a spiritual guide or sidekick. Now, in the Christmas Carol, this is right on the nose. So I don't really think I need to explain it other than to say that in this version, we have an extra ghost. We have five instead of four, because instead of just Jacob Marley being his partner, it's Jacob and Robert Marley. Third, we have to have a seemingly impossible external conflict. Well, again, I think that's really kind of on the nose in this, because ghosts don't literally exist. We cannot literally travel in time, yet we'll go with it anyway. Four, ghosts from the protagonist's past torment him. In this story, we have the ghosts of the Christmas past, present, and future, and we also have Jacob and Robert Marley's ghosts. But this refers to the protagonist's inner demons. And Scrooge certainly has that. I mean, he was very lonely in his childhood. But primarily the ghost from his past is losing the love of his life, Belle. And that's the one that really haunts him most of all. Now, in the book, of course, it's also the death of his sister, but that's not in this version at all. And that would be Fred's mother, obviously. And finally, aid from unexpected sources. Well, the ghosts are certainly unexpected, and they all serve to help Scrooge in some way. But I think the real help comes from Tiny Tim, because Tiny Tim represents everything that Scrooge has hated and has tossed aside. He's the one that, as someone pointed out a little earlier, when he's talking about the poor had better die and decrease the surplus population, well, this is Tiny Tim. He realizes now that that is who he was talking about, a small child or frog in this case. It sort of takes away the seriousness of it when I say frog, but you get the point.
It's so incredibly moving all the same.
All the same, he is totally. And of course, the other sources of help that come for Scrooge are when he hears Fred and Clara making him the butt of jokes, and he witnesses the commoners rejoicing at his passing and profiting at his passing in the future. But even though there are several sources, I think Tiny Tim is definitely the biggest unexpected source of help for Scrooge.
Excellent. I was going to add that under the impossible external conflict convention, the impossibility of solving poverty in Victorian London or any place else is also there. I mean, the conflict between Scrooge's personal wealth and comfort and the just he's surrounded by poor people who need something from him. That's also kind of a underlying impossible conflict. He tries to solve it, but he can only do so much.
That's right. And he does it for his own world, right? He might not do it for all of England, but Bob Cratchit is obviously the biggest player in his world at this point, and he certainly does help that situation. But I agree with you.
Now, this is an especially fun movie to talk about the narrative device and the point of view, which Kim is going to help us out with.
Yeah, so I have to say one of my most favorite parts about this version specifically, we do have the third person omniscient narrator by the great Gonzo as Charles Dickens and his sidekick as Rizzo the Rat. And they break the fourth wall often, and Gonzo is telling the story directly to the audience. They're filling us in with information and commentary between scenes, and they show scenes with and without Scrooge. There's a couple really funny moments where Rizzo asks him, how do you know what Scrooge is doing up there when he's out of view? And Gonzo replies, because narrators are omniscient. And so I was like, oh, well, thank you for that, Gonzo. And then at one point, when we're getting ready to meet the ghost of Christmas yet to come, who looks much like the Grim Reaper, they abandon us and say, you're on your own with this one, folks. We'll see you at the finale. So it was just fun to get that sort of interplay. And that's what the Muppets do so well.
It was great. It was a lot of fun. And it's interesting that the third person omniscient narrator, one of the editorial for third person omniscient narrator, which was real common in Victorian literature, sometimes that narrator actually does in the written form. I'm not sure it happens in A Christmas Carol, but you do see it where the narrator kind of turns to the camera, so to speak, and addresses him or herself directly to the reader. I don't know about you, dear reader, but in my opinion, and go on. And so they captured that sort of Victorian device in a very funny Muppet way here, which I thought was
and
great.
I love that device. I think so many of the stories I grew up reading had that. C.S. Lewis does that a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that feel. And it can be so much fun, especially when you're using humor. I think it really works well for that. So
it does. You want to talk a little bit about the objects of desire?
Yes. So Scrooge, he really wants to hide from the past and ignore the present. So he wants to hide from his past mistakes and regret. He wants to ignore the present, his fellow man, and the needs of his community. And certainly he wants to ignore the fact that he can, you know, thinking that he can continue living in this selfish way without any consequences. So he wants to just hunker down and be isolated and alone and not really have the outside world affect him in any way. But what he needs is to face the truth of the past, the present, and the future. And he needs to be changed by it for good so that he won't suffer the same fate as the Marleys. So wants and needs, pretty straightforward for Scrooge.
We gave ourselves a real break this week by watching a movie where these things are so clearly defined and straightforward. It was very helpful.
Yeah, it's just right there. And it's still so good.
And it's still so good. Exactly. So what about the controlling idea, Kim?
So Sean has his template that we can use when we're coming up with a theme. You take that value at stake, right? So in this case, since we're a morality story, we have either good triumphs or evil triumphs. In this case, it would be good triumphs when the protagonist sacrifices worldly or selfishly values in favor of the needs of others. So in this one, again, since I was kind of looking at it like with a society backdrop, I said, goodness triumphs or redemption occurs when tyrants embrace change and choose to live generously, sharing the wealth and power with those around them.
Very nice. That's good. Yay.
I noticed a couple, that Marley and Marley song that they do was definitely, again, on the nose. But they had one line that really stuck out to me where it said, freedom comes from giving love, prison comes with hate. And then at the end of their song, right as they're being taken away, they yell change really loud. And so, again, it's really on the nose, really gives us that redemption plot and, that he's in prison, basically. And he doesn't even realize it or wants to acknowledge it. And he's going to have to choose love for freedom.
I take it all back about songs not serving any purpose. That is that you can use the song lyric to just deliver the goods like that. And also, I thought that they were yelling chains.
No, it was change.
It's nice, though. I mean, nice little play on that idea.
I have to watch it with subtitles. Otherwise, I think I've always thought it was chains also. But on my subtitles on my TV, it said change. And I was like, oh, well, there you go.
Nice.
You're all about that.
Nice. Very nice. It's a great story. It's a timeless story, obviously, because there are so many versions of it. I looked it up on Wikipedia, and I was going to put a number in, and I just lost count. There are so many because it works so well. It's timeless, and we still enjoy it 150 years later. So I think we all had some ideas about special scene types, outstanding tropes, tie-ins to other genres. Kim, you wanted to lead us off on that?
Yeah, we kind of already touched on this, but this version specifically, and I'm sure, the original as well, and any Dickensian story is going to have that great omniscient narrator, the use of humor and calling attention to themselves. That third person omniscient narrator is certainly a lot less common in today's stories, but when it's done well, no one can argue. One of the most recent stories that had come to mind that uses it is The Book Thief, where death is the narrator. It's definitely a more serious tale than The Muppet Christmas Carol. I know it's kind of fallen out of fashion in a lot of ways when we really love that deep POV, but if third-person omniscient is something that's going to work for your story or your client's story, to not shy away from it, but just to make sure that what you're doing, you're choosing it with purpose and you're doing it well and executing it well, because it's one of those things that's just so classic and it really can just be such a great device to carry the story forward.
Hear, hear. I hate to see that narrative device die altogether. Valerie, did you have one to add?
I did indeed. So when writers are figuring out what genre that they're writing in, they make a choice from each of the five leaves on the genre clover. And in this particular version, as we mentioned before, they changed their selection from the style leaf and turned it into a musical. And that completely changes the whole way the story plays out. So I think it's just a really interesting example of how you can make one seemingly small change on one leaf and yet have it affect the entire story.
Really great point. Excellent point. Leslie?
I had two things I wanted to mention. One is that to me, it's interesting that Charles Dickens chose a ghost story, and I've been doing some additional reading to try to explore that, and I haven't found a great answer. But perhaps it is that to make the transformation plausible, that he's a lonely and frustrated old man, which reminded me of Mr. Potter in It's a Wonderful Life, that eternal damnation was the only, the only threat to him that was serious enough to move him, because he'd lost everything else that mattered to him over the course of his life. And that brings me to the second point that I wanted to make, is that it's been several years since I've either watched or read the story. And I was struck this time by a lot more empathy for Scrooge. In the past, he was the black-hearted man who was swayed. They didn't dramatize all of the scenes in this story that are in the book. And in the book, I think there's more of the why is he like this? And it seems to me that remembering those scenes from the book and then being the age I am and in the position I am, I'm more aware that Scrooge didn't end up the way that he was for no reason, that his upbringing definitely contributed to that, the way his father treated him. And so it makes him more sympathetic initially if I think about him in that context.
He wasn't in the movie and in the original book. He isn't set up as just a two-dimensional cardboard cutout bad guy with a black hat. Dickens very wisely showed us how he became that way. And this is pre-Freud, pre-psychology. He showed us how a person becomes, you know, their heart gradually blackens. But I also want to add that because this is a movie, because it's a musical, and because Michael Caine played Scrooge, he has a sympathetic face. And you do get more of a feeling of sympathy than you might just reading the book, because the camera just closes in on that wonderful sad-eyed face of Michael Caine's, and that certainly helped me sympathize with him.
Yeah, he's a fabulous actor, for sure.
Wonderful, wonderful actor, yeah. I don't know how you bring that into, you know, the written form. You can't get away with describing a great deal about a sad-eyed face, so you have to find other ways to convey that type of sympathy because you don't have an actor.
Yeah, I would say, you know, action, dialogue, you can do a little bit, I think, of the way the face looks or
sure. The
furrowed brow, but this is the difference between the scene development and what actors do with beats. The actor makes a huge difference.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons in the questions that we ask about the what's literally happening and what's the essential action in the scene. That's kind of the second one is kind of the actor's question. And what, you know, Michael Caine would look at this scene and say, essentially, I am trying to XYZ and reflect that in my face because it's not in the lines. And as the writer, you have to think, what's this character's essential action? And somehow you have to find a way to put it on the page in words.
That's the job, right? You want to take it to the next level? Figure that out.
I think it really comes down to subtext. You know, what Scrooge is saying to Bob Cratchit and the other bookkeepers versus this angry thought that he has, having his thought be slightly different than what he says out loud, or even like a sad thought that he refuses to let himself acknowledge, or, you know, you can show that kind of disparity between what's going on inside and the way he's dealing with his anger or his shame versus what he's doing outside. And then also, I think a lot of it comes down to POV, because then if you have the scene from Bob Cratchit's point of view, the way he views Scrooge, if he feels sorry for him, there's different ways you can show, because you have another character who is maybe wholesomely good, or, you know, the way his nephew feels about him. POV, I think, would be a huge way to play with that.
Another great case for using omniscient narrator. It's fun to do, and it gives you a lot more scope. Well, this has been fantastic, everybody. Thank you so much. We are going to look at the action genre next time. We don't know what the subgenre is yet, but we're going to watch Jack the Giant Slayer, and we'd like everyone to watch it and listen along. The links to the Fool's Cap and other materials for this show will be in the show notes, and we hope you will join us again next time for Jack the Giant Slayer and the action genre. We hope to see you next week.